This is Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia. I'm Cameron Wilson. If you've got a problem in the garden, stay with us. We'll tell you today how you can ask the world's very best farmers how to fix it. We'll also be marking a century since the adventure that spawned the first bushwalking club in New South Wales. Now, some claim this was even the beginning of a conservation movement. And we'll try to get to the bottom of what's killed thousands and thousands of shearwaters.
It was what we term a shearwater wreck. And these are events that happen generally once every 10 years or so, which indicate a poor year for shearwaters. But they seem to have been happening more and more frequently in the last decade or so.
We'll try to get to the bottom of that later today on Bush Telegraph. So we've told you before that cattlemen in the Gulf country are in a dire situation at the moment. They're in debt, they're in drought, and many of them are at breaking point. So that's why a group of them have just travelled to Canberra earlier this week for an urgent meeting with bank executives and also representatives from the federal government. Rob Atkinson is a Gulf Cattlemen's Association member, and he travelled 2,000 kilometres from his farm at Huendon to attend the meeting. Rob, welcome to the program.
G'day, Cameron. How are you?
Good. Long way to go. I hope it was worthwhile.
Yeah, well, we hope so too. I mean, wheels turn a bit slower in Canberra, but we think we highlighted the problems, and I think you know, there will be good things coming out of it.
Last time we spoke to your association, you were in the midst of a survey. Can you just recap the situation for us, just how tough it is for Gulf cattlemen at the moment?
Yeah, well, that survey, about a quarter of the producers in the Gulf area responded to the survey, and the two big things that came out of it was that it showed there'd been a 28% decline in property values since about the live export cessation, and there's been a 22% increase in debt levels.
Okay. So what, the value of your property on average has dropped 30% in about 3 years?
Correct.
Yeah, so no one would be too keen on that. You took a few ideas that you were hoping might be taken on board to solve this situation or go some way to at least easing the stress on the cattlemen. One of them was a government guarantee on stressed loans. What exactly were you looking for?
Well, we're on a bit of a steep learning curve too, but loans are categorised by the banks, and there's loans that are being serviced well, and there's loans that aren't. And the loans that are under pressure are people having trouble meeting interest payments and such. They might fall into what's called a B category, B plus, B minus. And the banks apparently have to have some cash set aside to meet any requirements if those producers go bad. They can't have that money out there in the marketplace working for them. So a government guarantee on those loans would have meant that banks could have freed up some of that money and sent it out into the marketplace to work. And if that had have been allowed to have happened, we would have called for cheaper rates of interest, so that we got more, our producer got more chances of meeting those interest payments.
Okay, what happened to that idea? You said if it had have happened, did it get knocked on the head, did it?
Yeah, it was considered for sure, but, that's basically what Qantas went to the federal government with, a couple of months ago, and that got knocked back, and the minister, he thought it was a better idea to work with the structure that's in place around farm finance packages.
This is the Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce?
Correct.
Yeah.
And to make some changes that'll make some of those packages more accessible.
So what, this is tinkering around the edges of drought support, is it, instead?
Yeah. Mm.
Is that sufficient for you?
Well, it all depends how much tinkering, I suppose, Cameron. We don't know that yet. And if there are changes, to the cap, which is currently $1 million, or half your debt, if there's changes to that cap, because up here in the enterprise with a fair bit of scale is often a lot more debt than $1 million, and they are loans, and we've asked for more time and a raising of the cap, and be great if there was an interest rate applied that was a lot closer to the RBA rate.
Okay. I see you've also suggested the idea of exit packages. So what's that, essentially using taxpayer money to pay producers to walk off the land?
Not necessarily taxpayers' money, but there's a couple of ideas floating around where tax credits on losses that producers have accumulated over the years may be used so that they can exit with a bit of dignity. And because you've got to remember, when a producer is forced off the land, they're also forced from their home. In most cases, you know, the farm is also where your home is, and so we just want to make sure that those who are unfortunate enough not to get through this torrid time can do so, and with a bit of dignity attached to it.
But have you pushed for this because you get a sense after your survey, your group survey, that there are people out there that just want to get out if they can?
Oh yeah, there's people who are, you know, pretty sick and tired of you know, we're going into our third year of drought now, and it's been a real battle. And you know, if you happen to have a sizable debt and you've got no livestock left, it's very hard to service a debt when you've got no income.
So what happens to that country then? If you've got producers that want to leave, are there others that are prepared to take on these stations when it's in the middle of drought and there's no immediate prospect of things improving?
Well, you know, right now there's properties that have been in receivership that are coming onto the market, and you know, like the place around here reportedly sold the other day for less than half of what it sold for about 5-6 years ago. If those sorts of deductions on the values of properties are made, you know, it's going to affect everyone's equity. The people, most probably aren't going to come on the market until it rains, because they're not presentable at the moment. No one's going to want to buy a property in the middle of a drought, or not many are anyway.
What's the country actually look like? You're on the road through the Gulf today. You've pulled over to have a chat with us. What do you see when you drive around?
Oh, there's very little grass. You don't see many livestock now. They've either been moved or sold. It's you know, it's starting to heat up. We'll get up towards 40 degrees later or early next week. And soon as this heat cranks up and you know, we just can't wait to see some storm clouds and some wet season. I mean, hopefully this coming wet season is at least going to be an average result, because this country all needs a break in the season big time.
Needs a decent drink. Look, clearly the situation's bad. So you're waiting for more information on the exit packages. You've had the idea of the government guarantee on stressed loans pretty much knocked back. You are also seeking a survey by the banks, in addition to the survey that your association had done, to get a better handle on the extent of the problem. What was the outcome there?
Yeah, well, banks used to hold debt surveys. There hasn't been one in Queensland since 2011. We believe the situation's got a lot worse since 2011. So. You know, it's one thing for us to roll up and say, you know, things are really bad, and we have this one survey in our pocket to prove that. But if they do a, you know, in-depth survey, drilling down into all the, you know, all the data they can, that real solid data, then at least some decisions can be made. The minister, you know, obviously, the more data you've got, you can highlight where and what the problems are and act on that. And so, yeah, the banks agreed to get the data on a few real hotspots.
But will it tell you anything you didn't find out for yourselves? You had 140-odd respondents, and you came up with this assessment that property values are down by 30% and and the average debt has increased by more than $1 million, so increased by 20%, what are the banks going to discover that adds to that?
Oh, well, I suppose, Cameron, it's the data we retrieved, not the data that they retrieved, and all the banks retrieving all their data from all their clients would I'd imagine, be evidence that they can't give on. They'd have to, you know, they'd have to say, yeah, this is very creditable. If they're not saying our evidence isn't creditable, but I suppose they're
they want to know it for themselves, which I guess you can understand, can't you? You've also got a commitment to mediation, I see, so that it might change some of the complaints, or at least address some of the complaints we've heard that banks are being too aggressive when pursuing bad debts, or at least producers that are under stress. What happens next, Rob?
Well, we would love to see, you know, no more foreclosures until this data's sort of tabled, and we'd love to see no more foreclosures, full stop, or at least until the wet, because, you know, if there's a strong wet, cattle prices have rebounded very well in the last 3 months. You know, that's the real positive. Like, we've been told for years that, you know, it's going to, Southeast Asia and China are going to be strong. Well, it appears now that that's going to happen. We've got two things. We've got a shortage of cattle now, at least in Queensland, probably Australia, and we've got a stronger demand than probably we've ever had. So those two things mean, surely, that beef prices are going to be strong at the farm gate going forward from here. So that's fantastic. We just need to get as many people to this wet season that we can.
Yep, you just need people to hang on. All right, Rob, keep us up to date with the next round of meetings with the banks and the federal government. Thanks for your time today.
Good on you, Cameron. Thank you.
Rob Atkinson, who's one of the members of the Gulf Cattlemen's Association on Bush Telegraph now. Time for Rural News. Tony Allen's joining me with today's Rural News. Tony, big changes, sort of big changes, for people that are boarding the Spirit of Tasmania, the ferry that runs between Tasmania and Melbourne.
Yes, well, we know Tasmania is very protective of its quarantine status. If you fly into Tasmania, you'll see sniffer dogs at the airport. They're not necessarily after drugs. They're after food. And the same thing happens at Devonport when you come in on the Spirit of Tasmania. But there's a trial system being introduced now, which the Tasmanian government says is going to be of great benefit to the state's agriculture. They're going to see cars and passenger luggage checked when people get onto the boat at the Port of Melbourne instead of doing all the checks on arrival at Devonport. This, of course, will make it quicker to get off the boat, which is a useful thing. But Tasmanian Primary Industries Minister Jeremy Rockliffe also says it means that illegal plants, fruits and other foods will get discarded at Melbourne, so they don't even get anywhere near Tasmania.
This new system is all about is ensuring that we have a continuum of biosecurity from embarkation at Port of Melbourne, greater information through the journey and education and awareness through the journey.
Okay, so some changes there that you'll notice if you're hopping on at Port Melbourne in Melbourne. I guess they needed stricter biosecurity for Kangaroo Island.
Yes, well, another island connected by ferry is Kangaroo Island, 15 k's off the coast of South Australia, and the that nasty beet western yellows virus has made it to Kangaroo Island. Now, Kangaroo Island is another area that's very protective of its quarantine status as well. But somehow the virus has made it there. It's transported by green peach aphids. It's infected canola crops already right across South Australia and in parts of Victoria and New South Wales. And now farmer and agronomist Jenny Stanton from Kangaroo Island says she was surprised to see that beet western yellows virus has severely damaged her canola crop on the island, even though the plants were fairly mature.
My husband noticed the crop looking a bit awful in a patch, and I went out there and had a look, and I thought maybe it was sulphur deficiency, and then as the weeks progressed, no, it went bad. And it's here now. There's no pods on the plants. They're flowering, but there's just nothing developing on the plant.
It's a serious problem, this disease.
It's very serious, and canola's a very big crop.
Yeah, if you drive, I was in the Riverina earlier this week, and you see the yellow flowers everywhere at the moment, so you get a sense of just how important it is to farmers. All right, not so long ago on Bush Telegraph, we had a story about what they call bee vectoring overseas, where you basically dust bees with pesticides or herbicides, and they do the work for you instead of spraying. This is happening now in Australia, is it?
Yes. Dr. Katja Hogendorn from the University of Adelaide is experimenting with cherry growers in the Adelaide Hills. They're doing a trial to combat cherry brown rot with bees instead of sprays. Normally, the growers have to spray twice during the flowering season for this fungus. It's labour-intensive, it's costly, and if you can get the bees to do it for you, of course, there are some additional advantages apart from the fact that it's cheaper. A lot of the cherry orchards are on hills. It's quite dangerous to bring machinery up and down those hills. The bees don't worry about the hills. Also, the bees work on Saturday and Sunday without penalty rates. They've contacted some cherry growers and they're very interested in taking part in these trials. Dr. Hogendorn says she was inspired to do this by the successful studies in Europe with strawberries.
What happens is the beekeeper fits a dispenser in front of the hive and the grower gets a mix with beneficial spores in it, and those beneficial spores need to go to the flowers.
So it's outsourcing your spraying to the bees.
I just think it's such an interesting development, this, using bees to do the work of humans now or machinery. Really interesting that they're more than just honey creators and pollinators for us now,
aren't they? Very useful things, bees.
Mm. Yep. Before I let you go, Tony, you're presenting Country Breakfast tomorrow, just after 6 a.m. on RM. What can we look forward to?
Well, we're going to have a good look at China, the relationship with food between Australia and China. We keep getting told that, China is the future, blah, blah, blah. But it really is true. And we're going to look at a couple of aspects of it. One is what China wants to buy from us. Mm-hmm. And some of the people we'll hear from include Andrew Forrest, the cattle magnate, or mining magnate, really, who has also diversified into cattle. He's set up a long-term agricultural partnership with China and is very enthusiastic.
Alpaca magnate as well, isn't he, from the early days?
Oh, he's into everything, I think. And also Jessica Rudd, who's been appointed an certified organic ambassador to China, and she lives in Beijing. And she'll tell us how she's seen people pay $100 for a tin of organic baby formula from the United States. They only get one crack at being a parent, so they're
$100,
and they're prepared to pay absolute premium price for stuff because they only get one crack at it. There's two sets of grandparents and a set of parents all devoted to one child, and there's a huge market there. So she'll talk about that. And
I hope Australian baby food doesn't become benchmarked against the Chinese price. We'll be in trouble, won't we?
Well, it's going to be interesting, and the dairy industry is very excited about it. And the other side of the story is that China wants to buy our farms, particularly our dairy farms. Mm,
okay. Will we hear you use the term food bowl of Asia in the program at all tomorrow?
I have attempted to avoid it.
Yeah. All right. You have a good weekend. Thanks, Tony. Tony Allen with today's Rural News. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN.
I find that disrespectful, a pensioner magnet. Don't you find that disrespectful?
What I'm interested in is if you believe that an older person has nothing relevant to say to a younger person.
There's a difference between being chronologically old and being Naomi.
Me, Ricky and Tim. A radio show about a radio show. Sunday at 3. Here on RN.
Intriguing, hey? Might even say fascinating. Tune in Sunday to find out more. Cameron Wilson with you for Bush Telegraph. Now, at this time of year, millions of short-tailed shearwaters, or mutton birds as they're also called, migrate from Antarctica to Australian shores and they migrate to breed. Last year, though, you might remember this, we told you at the time, thousands and thousands of the birds washed up on Australian beaches dead. They were all the way up and down the east coast of Australia. There were some even washing ashore on the WA coast, and some were even found in New Zealand as well. So this mass die-off is normally considered a once-in-a-decade event, but it's happening more readily now. So in a bid to find out why, scientists are working on a program on Phillip Island, which is in Victoria's southeast. Our reporter Jenny Henderson met up with senior research scientist at the Phillip Island Nature Reserve, Duncan Sutherland.
So what we're standing in front of at the moment is a shearwater nest box. So it's an artificial nest that protects the nest construction itself so that we can come along and look into the nest without collapsing the burrow. Because the burrows that the shearwaters produce are actually quite fragile. So what we've got here is it's a box. It's roughly about 50 centimetres by 50 centimetres by 50 centimetres. And it's made out of treated pine, so it can withstand the elements for quite some time. In it is, it's actually got a few gaps in it so that the water that might come in can drain away. And it also has, coming out of the box, a chute, so a tunnel entrance, a burrow entrance, which can extend up to the surface. So this whole box actually gets buried underground. And when we actually want to check the contents of the box, we have a big lid which sits over the top. So we can take the whole lid off and have a look inside. So that's if we wanted to actually mark a bird and check what the contents of that nest are.
How many of these do you have?
In all, we've now got about 180 of these boxes. So we've just put in about 150. We already had 30 nest boxes in the ground. But now we actually have enough boxes and enough nests that we can monitor to see what's really going on with the population.
That's quite a few boxes. I understand you've had a bit of help making them.
We have. We've had lots of volunteer groups, groups from the community, from universities, from high schools, and even the scouts have come along and given us a hand. So it's been just such a fantastic effort from everyone putting together these really solid boxes which should last us for a long time.
As you mentioned, the burrow usually of the shearwater is quite fragile. Have you tested this out with the bird yet? Are they taking to the wooden box as opposed to their usual dwelling?
Well, as I said, we've got 30 boxes already in the ground, and they took up those boxes in the first year that they were put in. So we're pretty confident that they'll take up the rest of them.
Whereabouts are you placing these boxes?
So they're in a shearwater colony, which is quite large, next to the penguin parade. So it's behind the Summerlin Beach area, and they're lined up against or next to tracks so that we can access these nests without collapsing other natural burrows that are around those nest boxes.
Maybe we should go out and have a look at some of these in the wild.
Absolutely.
So the track we're walking up now is not usually used by the public. You've sort of deliberately put these boxes out of the way of where people can get them, but that's usually the problem for shearwaters, isn't it? Interference in their environment.
It's one of the many challenges that they face. The habitat that they use has certainly been affected in the past, but also things like harvesting of the eggs and chicks in past days and years gone by has certainly affected the populations. But there are all sorts of issues that they face in the environment to do with foods, resources, pollution in the marine environment, which also affect the population. And that's why we want to try and monitor what they're doing and how successful they're being each year. So what we're looking at is, it looks like a pile of dirt in some ways, just a turned up patch of soil. But under it are a series of boxes. In fact, there are groups of 10 nest boxes, all very closely spaced together.
Now I can see also, apart from the chutes that lead to the burrows sticking out of the ground, there's some what looks like plastic tubing. Can you describe what that is?
The pipe has a cap onto it, which we can remove. And we've got a little burrowscope here, and it's a camera on the end of a stick. And we can extend that down into the tube and see if there's anybody home. They look very odd, actually. The other purpose for them is that they provide some ventilation, so the contents and the birds inside don't get too hot or too humid inside. So they're really quite useful.
Do you think there'll be some birds in these boxes?
There shouldn't be any birds just yet, but we're expecting a massive influx of shearwaters. Actually, later on this week should be the peak time for their return.
Last year there was a bit of a tragedy that washed up on the shores around here. Can you describe how many birds you found dead?
We found an awful lot of shearwaters washed up dead on the beaches around Phillip Island. In fact, it extended all the way up the east coast of Australia. And in fact, there were some even on the west coast of Australia and in New Zealand. It was what we term a shearwater wreck. And these are events that happen generally once every 10 years or so, which indicate a poor year for shearwaters. But they seem to have been happening more and more frequently in the last decade or so. We're quite concerned about what might be causing that kind of collapse in the population, and hence why we're trying to monitor them more closely.
What does monitoring the breeding have to do with monitoring the population as a whole?
Well, we're trying to understand whether they're actually successful in breeding. That indicates that they're getting enough food locally, and by locally that could be down to the Antarctic shelf and back. Do the eggs that they're incubating survive? Or do they even lay an egg in the first place, which in many cases last year they didn't? Do those eggs hatch, and is the chick actually brought up successfully, fed enough food, enough so that it is able to fledge and make the extraordinary journey that they make all the way up to the Bering Sea in the Northern Hemisphere?
You've got the breeding boxes here, but what else are you doing as part of studying these birds and their breeding?
What we also want to know is where those birds are actually going. We don't fully understand what are the journeys that they undertake, where they go foraging, and where they make these trans-equatorial journeys. Where do they stop off along the way? Do they stop off? How long does it take? So we actually attach very small devices to them, little band on their leg, which holds a geolocator, which is a very light little piece of technology which records light levels. And those devices can basically tell us where on the globe that animal is at any particular time. There's lots of error in those locations, so you know, plus or minus 100 kilometres or so. But for a species that's travelling the globe, that's perfectly good enough for our purposes.
How long will the research take, and what do you hope to find?
We will be monitoring these burrows into the long term. There's no definite end to it, but we will always be looking at the data each year to make sure that we understand what is going on in any one particular year. For these nest boxes, it's really to try and understand breeding productivity and survival of the eggs and the chicks and the adults.
How do you feel to be involved in research like this and helping this bird?
To understand, or try and understand, what makes this bird a successful coloniser of islands like this, that can do the most extraordinary aerial acrobatics and is incredibly clumsy on the ground. But to be able to study them is just such a privilege.
That's Duncan Sutherland, who's a senior research scientist at the Phillip Island Nature Park, speaking there with our reporter, Jenny Henderson. Stay with us on Bush Telegraph. A little later, we'll talk with the founder of a website called Plant Village. It's a really incredible website. It started as an idea to help African farmers improve their management of farms and their productivity, but it's become, I don't know if you say much more than that, it's become something quite different. It still does that, but it's also seen gardeners and veggie growers from all around the world posting pictures and questions on this website about the problems they're encountering in their garden, and they're getting answers from experts, the best agricultural researchers, leading farmers, just some of the leading agricultural thinkers around the world. So we'll talk to the founder of this website a little later. It's really interesting stuff, so stay with us. First though, Mia Dyson, Liz Stringer and Jen Clower are members of the eponymous Dyson Stringer Clower. Tonight on the live set at 8 p.m. you will hear them performing earlier this year at the Crossroads stage, at Blues Fest in Byron Bay. So we're going to bring you a touch of what you'll hear later tonight. This is the track When the Moment Comes.
I saw my vision.
when the moment comes. Dyson Stringer Chloe, that's live at the Blues Fest earlier this year. If you liked that, plenty more tonight. The live set from 8 p.m. If you miss it tonight, can't make it tonight, it's repeated Sunday at 4 o'clock. 4 in the afternoon, 4 p.m. Right now you're listening to Bush Telegraph. Cameron Wilson with you. Well, thanks to my next guest, you can now get advice on just about anything you want from the world's most experienced farmers, the world's leading plant researchers, and the world's very best gardeners. Dr. David Hughes developed a website that's sort of a Facebook meets Wikipedia meets Yahoo Answers, if you like. The aim was to help improve farming in Africa, but while it's doing that, it's also become something else. It's now improving gardens in Brooklyn and Karachi, Dubai and beyond. This website's called Plant Village. Its creator, Dave Hughes, joins me now from Penn State University in the US, where he's Professor of Entomology and Biology. Dave, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Cameron.
How would you describe the website? I've just given it a go.
So Plant Village is a platform that myself and my co-developer, Marcel Salate, also at Penn State, developed. The idea was that we could do a better job of sharing knowledge. So Marcel is a big expert on social networks, and I've had a lot of experience working in different places around the world and know a little bit about plant diseases. And given that the people around the world, whether they're in farms or in gardens, have in their pockets mobile phones that have more computing power than Apollo space missions, an obvious thing that we could do is link up those to accelerate the speed at which people can share knowledge and find knowledge, and of course then use those really handy cameras which are on the phone. And so with this idea, we created a library of knowledge around 153 crops and about 2,000 diseases. And one of our helpers, Lindsay McMenemy, has been doing a wonderful job of taking content which is currently behind paywalls at universities and rewriting it. So firstly, it's all free. And then secondly, we write it in a simple way. A lot of the content which has been written about agricultural work has been written by scientists for scientists. So we just want to write in a simple, easy-to-understand way for our growers of all stripes. And in addition, sometimes we're actually translating that into different languages, so French for West Africa, for example. And so we've created this enormous library and a network of librarians so people can find information, share information, and as you say, tap into the very best research which is out there and the best expertise.
Mm. So there's this underlying philosophy there that this information should be available to everybody. But in addition to that, in addition to sharing information, what are you actually hoping to achieve with it?
So we've been going for about 20 months now, and in that time we've had over 500,000 users. And so obviously we're filling a niche. And imagine if you go to 5 million or 50 million or 500 million. I mean, everybody on the planet requires food, and a lot of people are busy growing it, either because it's literally their daily bread or because they're living in cities and they want to reconnect with agriculture in some way. So imagine if we have all of those people growing food and
We might have lost our professor there. No, we'll just see if we can get hold of Dave Hughes. Again, I've got with me Dr. Dave Hughes, who's the developer of a website called Plant Village. I encourage you to have a look for yourself. It is basically farmers or gardeners or anyone in between from right around the world that has run into an issue, a problem with one of their plants, who then post a picture along with a question. And the best minds, whether it's scientists, researchers or farmers, then answer the question. I think we've got Dr. Dave Hughes back with us again now. Dave, this started as an aim to improve farming in Africa. Is it actually doing that?
It really is. We have about 7 to 9% of our traffic is coming from sub-Saharan Africa, and people from Kenya are posting questions on how to grow cash crops. We had a question currently on the homepage at the moment from Cameroon about how to grow oil plants. And so, yeah, we're getting a lot of really excellent questions either about healthy plants, diseases, or how to manage soil and irrigation.
I love that about this site, that you've got, here you go at the top, yeah, a question from Cameroon about a problem in 200 acres of oil palm plantation. But flick over the page and it's someone's mint in Brooklyn that's the issue.
Yeah. So it's all, no matter where you are, you're unified by the goal of trying to grow a better food plant. And you can easily grow grapes in Australia just as you do in California, as you do in France. And they're the same grapes and same problems. And what we can do now, because of the web and the connectivity we have, we can connect people in a way we've never been able to do in the history of mankind. It's quite exciting.
Is this the sort of knowledge that if we go back several decades would have just been exchanged at whether it was local markets or meeting places when your average farmer was quite diverse rather than highly specialised?
I think so. What we're doing is an extension. We're taking knowledge and we're extending it. And we've always been doing this. I mean, there are records on Egyptian hieroglyphics, records in Roman and Greek societies. We've been doing this for thousands of years, ever since, I guess, we've domesticated plants. And previous, the last 20, 30 years, the governments were doing a really good job of this. But as we all know, there's been declining funding in public service and public sciences. And so it's not going to increase anytime soon. But at the same time, we have all these farmers connected, and farmers are really good sources, as well as all other growers, at providing knowledge, sharing knowledge, and then evaluating the content.
Is there also, is it to some extent a pushback against the fact that more and more research now is privately funded, which means the knowledge that is obtained is it's of corporate value, and it's for that reason that it's secretive to some extent?
Yeah, there is that element. I would like to see the people who work in industry be part of this movement as well, because there's a lot of knowledge there which is outside the competitive marketplace. But you're absolutely right. Companies do have a vested interest in holding knowledge because that's valuable. And then maybe the farmers are not getting as much information as they could, or they're being told about one product where it may not actually be useful, because if companies are beholden to shareholders, they're not necessarily going to give the sort of information that is unbiased. Whereas public universities have always done that, but if we're not funding them as much as we could have done or should have done, then they're not going to have a lot of people out there. So why don't we just open it up to the world through phones, and we can have everybody part of the conversation and evaluate whether a product that is possible to use, whether it's actually beneficial to you at that moment in time.
So I guess we also see this situation now where if we talk farmers as opposed to gardeners, the farmer might buy their seed, say, from a certain company that also provides the advice and the chemicals, and they become maybe not captured, but they're definitely entwined in one way of thinking. Perhaps this could get them out of that?
Yeah, and I completely agree with that. So I've got colleagues here who work in central Pennsylvania in the U.S., and they also work in the outback in Africa or in Bangladesh. And they often say that they, with their minimum amount of money, will travel on a four-wheel drive to get to some place, and they'll find that a company's already there ahead of them. In the same way, Coca-Cola is already there ahead of them. So there's this ability of companies to have an enormous reach because they need to. And so it's very difficult to combat that as a public university. Mm. But given that we have phones, we can do it much, much more easily now.
Are you running into to problems in Africa, at least, just because the technical ability or the access to communication or computers or whatever it might be in Africa is lagging behind? There's just not the capability to tap into this resource?
Well, it is, absolutely. So Ghana, which is a highly developed country, has internet connectivity equal to the U.S. about 10, 15 years ago. But they're not going to take another 10 or 15 years to catch up. So already there's 700 million mobile phones on the continent of Africa. And people are predicting that in the next 2 or 3 years, there will be 80% of Africans will have smartphones. And so we're already seeing what they're doing with phones. They're revolutionizing banking. They don't build brick-and-mortar banks like we do. They just leapfrog that and go straight into banking over the phone and exchanging cash. Well, they don't have to build great research universities like we do, although that would be a good thing. But they can still get the knowledge because the knowledge has already been collected. So since they have the phones, they could actually leapfrog all the public service experimental stations that Australia, England, US, and other countries have built over the last 150 years or so.
So I guess, yeah, you're essentially making sure the resource is there for when the technology does totally catch up. Clearly, if you're giving advice or through this website advising farmers around the world in Africa, developing countries, how to improve their production, it's fairly important that that advice is accurate. How do you make sure that it is correct?
Yeah, so that we always got that question early on, because it's the web and it's full of crazy people. But in fact, you know, for 20 months we've been doing this experiment and we're just getting high-quality questions and high-quality answers. And we have a gamification system, so you vote off the best question. Of course, if we see anything that's untoward, we as moderators go in and remove that. But it's just a good community. I think people are just generally happy to share information, and that's what we've been seeing over this last 20 months. So we haven't had any misinformation. We've had a great diversity of information. And it's interesting how sometimes the question and answer will itself become a source of knowledge for new people, for people coming on, which you'll find through Google. So our top question has been viewed 33,000 times. So that itself becomes a really beneficial resource. So so far, everything's going really well.
I guess it's a natural progression, isn't it? We see these the development of open universities sharing knowledge. There's things like Khan Academy now where people can learn about science without having to pay. This seems a natural progression for agriculture to get on board in this as well. My guest is Dr. Dave Hughes, who's the developer of a website called Plant Village, as he says. It's been running for about 20 months now. He's also from Penn State University in the United States, professor of entomology and biology. Dave, have you been stumped at any point? Some questions that you just can't answer?
Oh, yeah, and I think that's extremely interesting. We get questions on diseases, say, of a palm in Vietnam, or it's also in developed countries, and we find out that there isn't an answer to that. We know that because we'll go to the very best people in the UK or US or elsewhere, and we'll ask them directly. And we'll go, of course, to all the books that we have access to. And we'll find that we don't know that information. Nobody knows that information. So as well as sharing what we know, I think this is a useful way to figure out very quickly what are the boundaries of our knowledge. And I think that's incredibly important in a rapidly changing world with globalization and variable temperatures because of global warming. We're going to see, of course, more pests and more diseases. And if somebody has a question and says, what's this, and we don't know, well, maybe that's a new thing that we really should focus on, because maybe it's just we're catching it at the beginning before it manages to spread. And I think this is something which would resonate with Australians, because we've had invasive species after invasive species there. Now we'd have a network of phones to act as...
This is an early warning system, is it?
Yeah, exactly. It's a sentinel system and would allow us to find these things.
Yeah, so... How far do you take that, though? Are you suggesting that, say, some of the big disease problems we've seen, Irish potato famine, for instance, could have been avoided? If we're going to see see something like that again, you could actually avoid it thanks to this community, this technology?
So I am Irish, and yes, I mean, that's one of the major reasons for me developing, because I look at many communities in sub-Saharan Africa, and I think of them at the same stage we were in 1845, when they're living on a monoculture and they have lack of access to knowledge, and so a disease could come in, as it has done throughout the history of mankind. Diseases have wiped out crops. But if it happens now in 2014, when all these farmers have phones or access to phones, I think that would be a terribly lamentable thing, because we could stop it with rapid exchange of knowledge, so we wouldn't have to go down the same route as the Irish went down, you know, in 1845.
Yeah. So this was developed with, what, about $120,000 US, I think, in funding from Penn State University. Is this how you thought it would develop and evolve, or are you learning as fast as the users, the community users, about what's possible here?
I think we are. I work in rainforests around the world and all over the place. I've also worked in Australian rainforests, and I'm not the kind of person you would think to come and try to help out an agricultural problem. Marcel Salaté, my co-developer, he's a computational biologist. He's worked with Twitter and lots of other big data. We're not the kind of people that you would imagine would be doing this. So yeah, we've got a little support, and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into it, and it's constantly evolving. But that's the story of the web, you know? It's the story of how Amazon disrupted bookstores. And the web is one, you know, this great medium of disruption, and we hope we can do that, you know, truly change the way we share knowledge about growing more and better food for everybody. And we know we have to do that, because soon enough there'll be 10 billion of us, and we all want to eat.
Yesterday on the program, we were talking about how we were looking more at how you educate kids about farming and the environment, and talking about digital media there and getting kids engaged through the web. It strikes me that this is a way of bringing older people, farmers and city people, in touch as well. Some of those connections that have been lost with our modern society, this is a way of building those relationships again.
I think so. I don't know about the stats for Australia, but in America, in about 1820, 1830, 85% of the people were farmers, and now it's less than 1%. So there's more people in prison in America than there are farmers. But 150, 160 years is not a long time, so people do feel connected to the land, and they want to be connected. And so even if you're just growing a few tomatoes in your balcony in a city, you can grow it, and you can learn, and you can exchange knowledge, and you can. I think we're an agricultural species, so now over half of us live in cities, but cities are a great place to grow food.
Yeah. I was surprised, though. I could only find one question from Australia, from Sydney, and yet you've got lots of other parts of the world, particularly South America, some from Africa, and a lot from North America included. I wonder why it hasn't quite got hold here in Australia yet.
So we've had over 25,000 people from Australia. So every day, about 5% of our traffic comes from Australia. There's quite a few more questions than that. You'd have to search through the many, many questions we have. But I was quickly looking at some. I saw one from ACT and one from Brisbane. And we have one of our, I hope she doesn't mind me telling her name, Karina Muller. I think she's in Tasmania at the moment. She's one of our really great people answering from Australia. One of our experts, a plant expert. So I'm really happy that it's 4.5% of people on the whole site are from Australia, given that the population is just 23 million.
Yeah, well, look, it's, as I said, really interesting development and a great, great sharing of knowledge around the world. Congratulations on it, and all the best for the future.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Cameron. Very happy to be on the show and share this. Thank you very much.
David Hughes, who's one of the developers of Plant Village, and also from Penn State University, he's professor of entomology and biology there. If you just put Plant Village into any search engine, you'll find it for yourself, and you'll see what I'm talking about. If you've got a question of something that's going on in your garden, maybe your broad beans don't quite look right, you take a picture, put it up, someone will tell you what's going on. You're listening to Bush Telegraph on RN. 100 years ago, Miles Dunphy and Bert Gallop embarked on a journey through the Southern Blue Mountains. It took 21 days and they snaked from Katoomba to Picton on a walk that has since been credited with igniting both Australia's love of bushwalking and also its ties to conservation. So today, a couple of young bushwalkers have set out to reenact the very same walk in their complete in period costume. One of them is Alex Auchin, and he joins me now. Hi, Alex. Where are you at the moment?
Hello, Cameron. I am currently walking down Nellie's Glen. So we've just left Katoomba, and I've had our walk launch, and yeah, I'm in the bush in my gear.
The original walk took 21 days. How long is it going to take you?
So we, I've shortened it a bit, and it's only going to take 11, but we've got 200 kilometres in total to cover. The main, differences are, I guess, we know exactly where we're going, and the other thing is, we're hoping not to have atrocious weather. So when they went, it absolutely flooded, and it was downpouring. They had massive rain, and when they were trying to cross the Cowmong, they had great difficulties, Sometimes they'd fall over. Some crossings took up to 40 minutes of standing in freezing cold, chilling water as they tried to make it across this river. That really slowed them down.
So, all right, a few things easier for you than in the than 100 years ago, but are you taking all your own food and supplies?
Yeah, so we are taking all our own food and supplies. We are cheating a little bit in that we've got a couple of resupplies along the way, but it's the same thing that Miles and Bert did. So when they went on the walk, there was actually a couple of towns that they could visit. So Denola and Keys, they were able to get resupplies there, and they're also able to get resupplies at a township called Urandri. So Urandri was, at the time, a little mining town for gold, only small, but they're actually able to get resupplies there. So we're reenacting that by having people come in and meet us at those points to give us some little top-ups.
So I'd argue that Miles Dunphy and Bert Gallop are not necessarily household names in Australia. Why do you think this is such a significant event, 100 years on from this original bushwalk?
Well, I think Miles Dunphy really should be. And in the bushwalking realm, he is. For the Southern Blue Mountains and New South Wales was just really the father of conservation there. He established with Bert Gallop the first bushwalking club in New South Wales, and he was the forerunner of protecting these magnificent areas that he went out with his friends and explored. You know, that's what he dedicated his life to. And it really, that's his legacy that really should be living on. Is this, you know, we've got the Greater Blue Mountains World Heritage Area now. That's finally been established in 2000, which covers a massive area. You know, he came up with that plan in 1932 and published it in the papers at Katoomba. So it took from then all the way to now to get it done. But he, that was his achievement, you know.
And so what basically spread this idea of walking in the bush as recreation rather than exploration?
Yeah, it really was. It was about the recreation and getting out there and enjoying. And it was about, he had this great connection with these places. And on his adventures, he documented everything. He was a fanatical map maker. He's made hundreds and hundreds of maps, many of which are still used by bushwalkers. They're all hand-drawn sketch maps, which have immaculate detail and fantastic names like, you know, Mount Strongleg and Paralyzer and things like that. And, you know, they just evoke imagery when you look at these things, and that's what's really inspired me. But his whole aim was to get people out there to enjoy these places and just share it with his friends and to get people out into the bush.
And so 100 years on, you're doing exactly the same, and you've got a few with you, I understand. So, look,
We do. We've got five teams that are completing the walk, the whole 200-kilometre section. So we've broken it down into five sections just to make it a bit easier and so that we can get more people out there and experiencing it.
Well, good luck with it. Keep an eye out for snakes. I had my family on a bushwalk on the weekend and we saw our first snake of the season. So
I'm sure we'll see a couple along the way and we'll keep our eyes out.
All right, and if people want to see the outfit that you're donning for the event, we've got a picture of you and your partner there up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/bushtelegraph. Thanks very much, Alex. Good luck.
Thank you.
Bye. Alex Ulchin, who is recreating that... reenacting, I should say, that walk by Miles Dunphy and Bert Gallop with, as you heard there, plenty of others through the Blue Mountains today. And a couple of comments there on our Facebook page as well about the importance of bushwalking and whether its ties are that strong to conservation or not. You can share your views there on our Facebook page. Look, that's Bush Telegraph for today and for the week. Big thank you to the entire team. The executive producer is Rowan Reid. Production this week by Kathy Pryor, Verica Jokic, Jeremy Story Carter, and Monique Bowley. My thanks also to Judy Kennedy for presenting the program earlier in the week. And technical production this week by Paul Penton, John Jacobs, and Mark Veer. We'll see you at the same time on Monday. Got a really interesting program organised for you. Unusual and innovative approaches to conservation. So tune in the same time on Monday. In the meantime, stay on RN.
Our national values and ideals are best realised at this time by the commitment of a force to the Middle East.
Airstrikes will not stop the Islamic State. It will require boots on the ground.
Australia is going back to war in the Middle East, though as so often before, there are questions about whether there's an exit strategy.
So how successful were we the first time round? Iraq post Operation Freedom. You can download this revision from the RN website.